The music business, in many ways, mirrors a high school cafeteria. I've used this analogy before. For a lot of people, going through high school at such an impressionable age, whether they realized it or not, created the blueprint for how they would socially interact with people for the rest of their lives. No more is it played out to the hilt than in the egomaniacal, infantile world of the music industry. The cliques, the in-crowds, the posturing, it all rests on creating conflict, basking in friction, solidifying divisive lines, and erecting walls on top of them. I sheepishly admit culpability when it comes to playing into this made-up schism, but only to level the playing field. Hard rock music, the music I've staked my entire life on, is now, in 2015, no longer in vogue. Despite its popular beginnings, it's become outsider music, slipping underground a good 15 years ago without the slightest indication of an upswing. That's fine. I've come to accept it. In fact, I revel in its square peg designation. But admittedly, a tinge of jealousy mixed with a bit of confusion is how I often feel watching softer musics get paraded, praised, and ultimately promoted to represent and define the spirit of today's music. It makes me bark back at double the volume in order to make up for what I see as an unfair chasm. It wouldn't bother me so much, but its newly attained status has somehow allowed its followers to adopt a smugness that I don't see in fans of other musics. For myself, playing in the band that I do, I'm fully aware that I've been super glued to the idea of embodying some sort of one-dimensional rocker character, unable to appreciate anything that isn't set within the narrow-minded confines of what others think rock is supposed to represent. I am also very aware of the importance of balance. In order for bands like Converge, The Stooges, Godflesh to have any severe audible impact, they must be offset by listening to a certain amount of disparate music and vice versa. Neil Young's Tonight is the Night sounds 10 times more poignant after a weekend of nonstop death metal, trust me. Offsetting my penchant for all things heavy with softer music listening keeps my chakras aligned and over the course of time has made me genuinely appreciate it. When I publicly rail against the endless vaunting of soft music, it's only an attempt to square up both sides of the fence when I see other harder music comparatively play to the sound of crickets. With the proliferation of soft music in the last 10 years, I've noticed a lot of novice members of its flock skittish when it comes to music listening, preferring to complacently stay within its boundaries. While I find myself praising Eric Chenault records or listening rapturously to the new Deers record, I don't see it conversely happening. But when you look at indie rock's principal players, heavy listening is a compulsory staple of their diet. Whether it's David Pajot's Dead Child, Jay Maskus' Witch, or Brendan Canning's obsession with Blind Vengeance, I challenge indie and hard rockers alike to come close to recording a groove as deep as Harry Nilsson's Jump Into the Fire. While alternately, Stephen Von Till and Scott Kelly of Neurosis put out solo records that can sit alongside any Elliott Smith or Bill Callahan record. This is lost on neophyte indie rockers. Ron Sexsmith is a singer-songwriter whose appreciation and love of many musics has had a direct effect on the great depth and emotion found in his songs. Ron is the great comforter, with the ability to quickly become a soothing voice to the listener. It's what keeps me returning to his albums when I need to hear someone sing to me with a graceful yet self-assured tone every time my surroundings get a little too intense and chaotic. I never leave home without at least half a dozen of his albums to accompany me on my journey. But my fandom pales when compared to JC and our band's love for Ron's music. When we had our first website back in, I believe, 1998, JC made sure there was a link to Ron Sexsmith online. He wanted to be on this podcast, but unfortunately couldn't make it. The chance to hang with Ron Sexsmith for a few hours was something he wouldn't so easily give up. Well, count JC in a long list of public admirers, everyone from Paul McCartney, Elvis Costello, Elton John, Steve Earle, and Sheryl Crow, to those like Rod Stewart, Feist, Katie Lang, and Michael Bublé, who have actually covered his songs. He is considered by many to be the consummate singer-songwriter. You won't get any argument here. He is the standard. I measure other artists in the genre too. And why I'm so critical when they think they come near to Ron, but really have a million miles yet to go. A month back, Ron stopped by to hang with Nick Flanagan and I. We had a great time. He's a great hang, so enjoy. I want to say a hearty thanks to all the people I've noticed who have left a Facebook comment or a tweet about this podcast online. If you like what you hear, and if you could, please leave a comment or a rating on iTunes. It's all I really ask because it helps the podcast's profile online. So far, there's been a lot who have, so I appreciate it. Either way, I'm really just glad you're listening. Thanks to Blue Mic Microphones for the Yeti mics and to Skull Candy Headphones for their Aviator headphones, Ron Sexsmith is this episode's guest on the official Danko Jones podcast, and it starts now. The Danko Jones podcast is the best around. Nick Flanagan is Danko's go out down for free. I'm so glad I like to sometimes. Damn it, from fucked up. Stop playing. Hang down. Down. Login protocol initiated. Sequencing algorithm interface. The official Danko Jones podcast uploaded. Listen with caution. Are you sitting comfortably? Then we'll begin. The Danko Jones podcast is simply superb. Splendidly fine, wonderfully wild, very divine.
We were started the conversation talking about Motorhead and how they have such a consistent sound. And, yeah. You know, to some degree, you can relate. You know, you have a very, well, your voice anchors your sound.
Yeah.
But one thing you do differently is all the different producers that you get that I guess gives you that different spin, like Mitchell Froom and obviously the Bob Rock thing. Your new album, which is coming out in February.
Now it's been moved to March, but yeah. I did it with a guy named Jim Scott in California, who's he's mostly known as an engineer, you know, but he's like engineered like a lot of big records. Like he did a lot of the Tom Petty stuff and, you know.
He's a secret producer.
Yeah, like Foo Fighters, all these people like that. But he, I had like three things fall through. I was starting to wonder, like, what is wrong? You know, I was supposed, for a moment, I was going to do it with Tony Visconti, which would have been really cool, right?
Whoa.
But we were talking, and he seemed really into it. And I don't know if he didn't like the songs or what, but they got back to us saying they didn't feel he was the right producer. So then I was kind of like all bummed out about that. Mm-hmm. And then I was going to do it with Bob again, Bob Rock, because that last album that I did with him actually did something, you know, especially in the UK. We had two top 10 songs, and that's never been, you know, the case, right? We did Royal Albert Hall. But we had a falling out kind of over, you know, the airbrushing of the... I'm not a fan of the airbrushing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, on that record, I really love working with Bob, but I have a hard time listening to that album now because I don't like all the auto-tune and all that. And all I did, I just asked him, is there any way we can do something that didn't have all that stuff? And he kind of took it the wrong way, and... so anyway, then I was going to do it with Don Was, which I was excited about.
Oh my God!
Yeah,
amazing too.
And then that looked like it was on. And then he called me one day at home and just said he felt really burnt out. He was doing a Neil Diamond record, and he said for the first time in his career he didn't have any ideas. Yeah. He was just kind of
his mojo.
Yeah, but he actually recommended Jim Scott to me because Jim was an engineer for Don on a lot of records and. And Kevin Hearn worked with Jim. And so anyway, he turned out to be just the right guy, you know. Was that the question?
No, but it was interesting to hear.
I don't know if there was a question. I feel like you just basically...
I was just making a statement
that... a lot of producers.
Oh, but the thing is, it's true. Like, I'm not a producer. So for me, that's what has given the records their whatever their personal... character or whatever, you know, because even the first three I did with Mitchell and Chad, they're all quite different from each other because, you know, we would try, you know, where are we gonna go this time, you know, like the third album we're with horns and strings and woodwinds, and the second one was more of a kind of sort of a folky thing. When the first one, the one that kind of brought my name out there, was very kind of sparse, you know, and it was like my voice up here and everything was kind of low down there.
Yeah.
So even when I work with the same producer, we try to do something different each time. Yeah.
I feel so out of touch with the scene now. Mm-hmm. I don't even, sometimes when people ask me like, oh, you're from Toronto, you know, tell us about the scene. Yeah. I feel so embarrassed that I don't know too much as I used to.
I feel the same way, you know. I mean, at one point, you know, I was, when I first moved here, I was part of a certain scene. It was like this open stage songwriter thing that Bobby Wiseman and all those kind of people. Mm-hmm. But I don't feel really like I'm a part of it, really, you know. I feel like I'm sort of the old dude, you know. I go to the commie, and you know, I see these people there. They're, oh, they must be in a band or something. I don't know who they are, right?
Nobody's in a band.
But Toronto is
half
is,
of them aren't.
Toronto is no has now carved out a name for itself in contemporary music today as being like, you know, with Broken Social Scene and Leslie Feist. Like,
for you know, Drake, like, you know, who never gets the credit though, I feel, is Jose.
Jose, you know, because
he's the original Broken Social Scene, right? Like Brandon, Feist, they all passed through the school of Jose.
All Hail Discordia one of the top 10 Canadian albums.
I mean, I think it's
time.
Amazing what Kevin and Brendan did, because they actually created this. Well, there wasn't anything before, and then they created this band that had so many offshoots from it. You know, and Apostle of Hustle and The Metric, even all that, Stars, you know. So I think that's pretty impressive. But I, when that came along, I was like, you know, I just, again, I'm on the outskirts of that, whatever that scene is. You know, I know all those people, but
you do, what I was going to leading up to was, do you find that all these, like, sort of quote unquote leaders of this indie rock thing, do you get the respect that I think you deserve from them? Wow. Or do you go, oh, or do you feel like you get a vibe going, oh, who's that guy?
I don't think, everyone's been really nice. I don't know if it's I don't know if anyone deserves respect or anything. But I just feel, you know, I've been...
I feel that you do. If you walk into a club and,
no, people,
you know,
are nice. People, Kevin Drew's always been really nice. And obviously, he just did one of my best friends is Andy Kim, you know. And Kevin just produced an album for him, which is pretty far out. You know, it's like, it's so far from Sugar Sugar. You know, it's this whole new... It's like Andy in this weird, nightmarish world, you know. And I just really respect Kevin for doing it, because... You know, I've tried to book tours with Andy, and people are like, why do you want to do that for? You know, because he's great, you know, and he hung out with Nilsson and Lennon, all these kind of, you know, Brian Wilson calls him, you know, I mean, I just love Andy, but I think it's really cool that I think they are, like, you know, Kevin has been, and all those guys have been very, I don't know if it's respect or whatever, but they've just been... there's support there.
I'm all about the respect.
Yeah, yeah. The How much do you guys spend playing Canada?
Well, that's the thing.
Because you do a lot of European stuff, right?
Yeah, we'll play, you know, Toronto once a year.
Right. That's the same with me, though. I can't play more than once a year in Toronto, or no one will come, you know?
Yeah.
And, which is crazy.
But that's what happens, I think, in your hometown. Like, I even heard that about Van Morrison recently. He'll, you know, he has a hard time playing Ireland because he's just played there so much, you know?
Yeah.
So, but... And, you know, someone like Leslie had to go to Europe to make it, right?
Yeah,
because she
definitely
wasn't being appreciated here. You know?
I mean, our first European tour was a skid tour, you know, just how it was. Nobody knew who we were. Mm-hmm. We started to become recognized at the end of that first tour, which is insane. Mm-hmm. Our first time we were ever in Berlin, we played a place called Wild at Heart, which is a small little club. It's still there. And Leslie Feist came.
Nice.
With Peaches. And it was just so nice to see... Mm-hmm. People from Toronto come to the gig.
Do you guys get to Japan and those places as well? Or
we played
Australia?
There once,
right.
And we've played Australia twice.
Yeah,
but I really keep. There's.
I always thought you guys would probably totally go over in those places too. You know.
That's I paraphrase what you just said in the first paragraph of my email I send out to everyone every 6 months about Japan? Question mark.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, they treat you really well over there.
Definitely,
have you been there a fair amount of times.
Well, we used to go there every record for years.
Oh, cool! Amazing.
And then there's this long period of time where we didn't go. But then the last 3 years, like we've done Fuji twice, and we've done
We did Fuji in 04.
Yeah, and that's a great festival because, like, it's so... Everyone, you don't get any sort of yobs, you know, causing trouble. Right. It's very mellow and everyone's really, really friendly. But so we've started making our way back there. And we did... They always have these thing where there's a club. It used to be called Club Quattro. And there'd be one in every city. So you just go play all the... Now there's a place called Billboard Live. And so when the last time we were there, we did two nights at Billboard Live Tokyo, which is just kind of like feels like dinner theater. It's like really great production and all lights. And
right.
And then we went to Osaka and did the Billboard Live there. But it's awesome because you're in the same town for a few days, you know, and all your equipment's still set up and you just go. And they always have this crazy feast for you too, right? They know how to make
I've heard about
everything this. Tastes good in Japan, you know.
Yeah.
Some vegetable that you hate here, they make it taste amazing. Isn't that weird? How do they do that?
You have some other food and it's chopped instead of chopped one way, it's chopped the other way, and you're like, cool, this changes it.
I was so happy. I was so happy to be in Japan when we went for Fuji Rock.
Yeah.
That I was watching, we were on stage and it was Sugar Ray played before us. You know how these festivals.
I just want to fly. But
And I mean, I'm not the biggest Sugar Ray fan.
Yeah.
But you could swear I was.
Yeah.
If you saw me side stage watching them, because I was just so happy to be there.
Yeah.
I was singing along to all the hits and.
You must like that song, Mean Machine. That's right up your alley, right?
Why? Because it's their heavy song.
It sounds like what Danko Jones' dream. Only in your wildest dreams.
The first time we were there, Neil Young was the headliner.
Oh, amazing!
And so we went. We did our set, and then we went and watched. We got to go on the side stage and watch him.
Oh, amazing!
And it was really great. It was like one of those. Really, I think it was a Crazy Horse. They were just rocking out, and then I look over to my left, and Patti Smith is beside me, and she's like, rocking out.
Oh
right?
My God!
And which so is my favorite thing about Patti Smith is that she's an unabashed music fan. She worships.
The people she worships, she really worships. Yeah. Like the Dylan, Lou Reed, all those people. Yeah. She just, Neil Young.
Remember her Cream reviews? They were literally.
I did go off on Patti Smith on stage a couple of years ago.
Why?
Because we were playing this festival and she was playing the same day, or maybe she played the day before.
Yeah.
And someone told me backstage. Asked me if they could take photographs while we were on stage. And I go, of course.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, sure. And he goes, well, I just wanted to ask because Patti Smith said no photographs allowed.
Yeah.
So I just took a mental note of that. And when we were on stage, after the first three songs, which is the general rule, all the photographers started to parade out and leave. And I stopped the song I just said, hey, come back. This isn't Patti Smith. And
right.
So I used her as
did
a
she way. Hear that or
I don't like, I'm yeah. a, I'm yeah. who am I to her? I'm just some maggot she'd probably give a 0 out of 10 review to in Frame magazine.
You don't think you'd get the run on sentence?
I remember I did a tour years ago opening for Sarah McLachlan. It was one of these shed tours that she was doing before Lilith Fair, whatever, all that.
Okay.
But I was doing this tour, and it was one of my first tours of America opening for her.
Amazing.
She was really nice, but we used to play Hacky Sack, our old crew backstage, and I had just happened during my set, I'd said, she plays a mean game of Hacky Sack. But somehow it got back to her that I'd said she was mean. Or something like this, right? And so it was this whole drama where I had to go see her in her dressing room. And I was like, what is this all about? Anyway, but she was really sweet. I thought I was going to get kicked off the tour or something. But she was really, really sweet. And, the whole Little Fair thing was always a bit of a thorn in my side because at that period in the 90s, if you were a female songwriter, you had it made. But I couldn't get arrested in the 90s.
Right.
I was trying to... I even offered to wear a dress, and just to do her little affair thing,
She
actually considered gotten
you arrested.
A moment. Yeah.
Lilith and Steve.
Yeah.
Lilith and Steve Fair.
Lilith Fair featuring Ron Sexton.
Yeah.
Featuring. Well, I think I would take most offense.
It is.
The fact that you guys were playing Hacky Sack, which is...
I'd never even heard of it before, but I was... she's a bit of a tomboy, so she was just like totally flying with
Oh my God.
Her feet were everywhere.
It's going to get back to her now that you called her a boy.
Tomboy.
That's cool.
She's from the East Coast, right? So she's...
Is she from the East Coast?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that's nice.
Ron Sexsmith thinks Sarah McLachlan is a boy.
A mean boy.
A mean boy.
Yeah, that's, I mean, it's weird. Like, those things like Lothair, I think they're so really good, really necessary, you know? And then there's this other thing where it happens in comedy, too, sometimes, where it's if you're a talented woman or, you know, you wind up with a lot of encouragement just because of the lack of encouragement that would be the default, you know?
Right.
And then you have the other side of it, which is there any way, like, soft-spoken, humble-ish people can maybe get there? Yeah. You know, can there be a festival for them? Or maybe a cable channel for them? Or
but something? I always felt that with my whole career, I've never been able to, like, I was never a part of any scene. And, and not that, maybe that's a good thing, but I used to always feel left out. Like, you know, everyone, poor me or whatever. But like, when I first came out in the early 90s, I was kind of one of the first songwriters at that time to kind of come out with this guitar after the 80s and sing without irony and without, you know what I mean? I was sort of a bit of a throwback, right? And then, like, even people like Ryan Adams and Elliott Smith hadn't really come out yet. They were in their bands or whatever, you know? And then a few short years later, they were all over the place. Mm-hmm. It was like Rufus, Ryan, and I didn't have that sort of thing. Like, Elliott had that extra cool factor. He was the heroine and stuff, and Rufus was really flamboyant, and Ryan was very good at, you know, he'd have temper tantrums, and he'd have a cigarette dangling in front of an old typewriter or something. You know, I mean, I couldn't do that. I didn't know how to do that stuff. So I always felt it was never really cool to be a fan of my stuff the way it was cool to be a fan of some of these other people.
Well, as a comedian, the one scene that I do see you part of is when you go on your comedy death rays, or you sort of step into that world, because they always have those kinds of like singer songwriters very often on the.
Well, I did comedy. I did Comedy Bang Bang. Once.
Yeah, that's yeah. I called it Comedy Death.
You were on Comedy Bang Bang.
Yeah, but I didn't know what it was. I was in Atlanta. I was so mad. I was kind of mad. I was with my manager. I go, why am I doing that? What is this thing anyway? And I now it's big. Right? Now it's, but I had no idea. I didn't know what it was. And I get there, and it was all done in a small little, probably like smaller than this, like this little. Kind of, it felt like somebody's like apartment or something.
Yeah.
And I was on there, and I recognized one of the comedians that was on from those roasts, you know?
Yeah.
Jeffrey Ross.
That's so funny. Jeffrey Ross.
And there was another girl who whole thing was she was imitating Sarah Silverman the whole episode.
Oh, yeah. It's not. Aubrey Plaza also does a Sarah Silverman impression, but this was not Aubrey. I heard that episode because I was excited that you were on
it. But I felt I was out of my element, you know? But I have a Twitter page where I just do puns all the time.
Well, I was going to get to that.
Me too.
I'm bringing two punnists together here.
I just wrote
it's a
today.
Pun down. I saw both of you guys tweeted puns, and I was going to like put them against each other to see who
today
wins.
I didn't have a very good one, but it's like every maybe 20th one is okay.
Oh, I understand this. And then it's like every 19 of them, you lose followers. And then the 20th one,
I like it because some people get so mad. It's like, oh, come on. Or they're like, stick to your day job or whatever.
People actually say that to
you? Well, sometimes they'll be like,
terrible.
I will tell you right now, those people are from Toronto. That is the attitude of people here.
I think most of them are kind of doing it in a funny way. It's hard to read the, you know, but
a funny way.
And the other day, but hilariously disrespectful. I also do, you know, I have a video channel where I do cover songs. I do like other things with it, but
it's cool.
But for me, like, I always like, I'm a big fan of Bob Hope and Jack Benny, that kind of humor. So for me, it's mostly dad jokes, you know, and I just stuff that I would have been torturing my band with. Now I have an outlet of.
Yeah.
Can I tell you the joke I wrote today?
Yes, go ahead.
Let's go.
I wrote RHCP. Are giving away their new album for Flea on iTunes.
Ah.
For Flea. Yes. Nice. You just had the pun reaction.
I was trying to get a pun with the word flea in it recently.
I've had a couple.
But it was like, have to flea on foot kind of deal. But I had never, I couldn't get the setup right, so I just passed
it. Yours was something to do with jazz hands.
Well, it wasn't really a pun, because they're not all puns. Some of them are puns, and others are just kind of stupid things. I was just sort of, I've never ended a show with jazz hands, but I have loaded out with stage hands or something. It was like something stupid like that.
I think we should follow each other.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm there. I tend to follow everybody, you know.
I do too. I feel really nervous. If I see someone with thousands of followers, I'll follow them. Days later, I'll notice they unfollowed me. Because their trick is they get thousands of followers by following people and then unfollowing everyone.
Right.
Don't fall into the trap.
Well, I've been trying. Like, so I didn't want anything to do with Twitter. And my when I put out my last album, the guy in the U.S. label guy said, you know, it would be really helpful if you got on even once a week and just said, you know, and I'm like, well, what am I supposed to say? You know, and I was like, so I got on there and I don't have a phone, right? So it's all on my laptop, Twitter.
Right.
And then the first person I tweeted was Beth Orton, who I used to know from the 90s, right? And I hadn't heard from her in years. And I remember, you know, there was a time where I used to see her quite a bit. And I was sitting with the tech guy from the label. I go, so I can tweet her right now? He goes, yeah, go ahead. And I'm like, hi, Beth. Within less than 5 minutes, it was like, hey, dude, how are you? And I was like, oh, my God, Beth, you know, I hadn't heard from her in so long.
That's a nice thing.
And for me, that was the cool thing originally, that you could, wow. And I've connected with some of my, like, Jimmy Webb, songwriters, people that I love that, or, hey, I'm talking, Cat Stevens was tweeting me the other night.
No way.
Yeah, you know, Engelbert Humperdinck, you know, because I sing a duet with him on his new record. You know?
No. Yeah. Okay, wait, stop the presses. Yeah. How did that happen?
Well, it's not that interesting of a story, but Martin Treffy produced a bunch of my records in England. He's a Swedish producer, but he did, like, Retriever, a couple of my records. He was producing Engelbert's new duets album with, like, and it's like everybody's on there, like Elton John, Dionne Warwick, Smokey Robinson, all this stuff, right?
The usual suspects.
And so Engelbert was saying to Martin, he goes, you know, it'd be nice to have one Christmas song on here because it's coming out in the fall or whatever. And I had written a Christmas song with Martin a few years ago that was just Collecting Dust. We wrote it for a Coke commercial. They asked us if we had a, and they almost used it too. They asked, the Coke people sent me a commercial with our song in it, and they awesome. They used someone else's.
Right.
And so it was just sitting there collecting dust, and Martin played it for him, and he really liked it. So they re-recorded it. And when I was in England touring a couple years ago, I went in and sang my part. And then about a year later, he sang his part, added a children's choir, and now it's on the record.
Oh, that's
so I never
amazing.
Got to meet him or anything. But since then, we've become Twitter buddies.
Amazing.
You know?
That is incredible. I'm a huge Humperdinck fan.
When I was a kid, I knew my mom was a big fan, and she had the Last Waltz album. And I knew every song on that record. Like, I would sing, you know, sing with a hairbrush in the mirror, the whole record, you know. So I was... And that's probably been the thing that she's been most excited about in my whole career.
Yeah,
you know?
That's how it usually is. Yeah. Yeah, Humperdinck is, I think, someone who gets looked over, glossed over when it comes to, like, the cooler guys. Like, you mentioned Neil Diamond before.
Yeah.
And who was the other one?
Tom Jones.
Johnny Cash. Yeah. Not that Johnny Cash and Neil Diamond are, but you know what I mean? Like, these older guys who suddenly get the new scrubbing from the cool hip producer.
Cool people.
And they get... But Humperdinck has never really gotten that.
When you think about Engelbert, there's this great photo of him with Hendrix and Cat Stevens on tour in the 60s. You know, and Engelbert was the headliner, you know. And because he beat the Beatles out of the charts with Please Release Me or whatever, you know. You see that photo of them and this looks like, whoa, what is going on here? Like three from completely different worlds, all three of them. But I respect any of those guys. I love... Anyone that, I mean, he had a great voice. And
he had an amazing voice.
You know, and I think of that time period, you had people like Scott Walker, who I really love, was, you know, we had the Walker Brothers. And Scott Walker has sort of since become this really, he makes these really experimental, crazy records. But at one point, he was like Engelbert in the 60s, this pop star. And Engelbert went a different way. You know, it became more of this very Vegas thing.
Vegas kind of guy,
But his voice, though, at that time was just as good as anybody's, you know.
It really is. And,
I mean,
it's
still good, actually.
Yeah, like Quando. I had the greatest hits.
Yeah.
And I used to listen to that over and over and over again.
Yeah.
And then later on, when people were like flushing out their record collections and they were selling it at bargain, he has no... His records go for a buck.
Well, most records. I mean, I go to the store down the street called... It's not called Nostalgia. It's near my house, but every record there's
for Neurotica.
Neurotica, yeah. So I walk by there and it's like, oh my God, are you kidding me? This is for a buck. And so because when
whatever, dude, it's not Fleet Foxes.
No, it's not a 3 LP Snoop Dogg.
But I love I love albums, you know. So it's great. And when they're a buck, there's some stuff I'll take a chance on this thing, you know. But like I bought a record by Phoebe Snow recently. It's her first album. And she died a few years ago. And I always liked her voice as a kid, but I never really had any of her stuff. Now, her first album is like one of my all-time favorite albums ever, you know? And that was just a buck at Neurotica, you know? And so It's kind of sad. You see this graveyard of albums there, but yeah, there's so much great music.
I was like 13. I remember going to a vinyl museum, which was an old Toronto institution. Worth mentioning, I think, on the podcast, in spite of its local
Peter Dunn's thing. Vinyl
Museum. Yeah, it was so crazy, you know? And I bought at the Buck album, you know, Born to Run. And
but you know what's so weird about Vinyl Museum was the insert, the inside sleeves of their vinyl was their own sleeve, and it would always have a Christian quote from the Bible. Tons of
religious tracts, yeah. Really?
Yeah. Which
In-N-Out Burger, similar. In-N-Out has like...
Really?
Yeah, it has biblical tracts.
Oh, well, they got... Was that the... No, I was...
That's Chick-fil-A.
Chick-fil-A, right.
Okay. No, In-N-Out is not that... It's not sort of, I don't think it's particularly political in the sense of hurting gay people. Yeah,
right.
I think,
hey, do you know the Westboro Baptist Church?
Oh yeah, they're good friends.
They made a sign for me. What? It said, repent, repent. It had my face on it.
That's a Ron Sexsmith shirt.
I know. Well, I told him. I said, hey, I emailed them because this guy started bugging me out because I had a song called God Loves Everyone.
I love that song, by the way.
And this, the leader of the Westboro Baptist Church, not Fred Phelps, but the new leader, whose name is Steve Drain, is his name, which is his, he started hassling me on YouTube about the song and listen to this, you know, F enabler, he would call me, you know, and all this stuff, right? And I sort of like I would hit back at him, and we had a few.
It's scary. It's scary to do that, though.
Yeah, I know, because I didn't want to engage him. But then he would try to, he would try to backpedal sometimes. He goes, you know, actually, I think you've got some really good songs. And I'm like, I don't care what you think about my songs, you know. And then one day I see they've made this poster that said
amazing,
you know, repent and as my face and I'm going hell and everything. I tweeted it on my Twitter page.
Oh, amazing.
And but it was kind of like a real proud moment.
In spite
of
the fact you're going to burn forever.
Yeah.
You have some really talented.
Yeah, I know.
Talent. Right.
I downloaded it, so I've got them.
But I thought that would be cool for a poster or a good... Or
yeah. Oh, that would be the best.
Or your Facebook splash page.
That's what you need to do. The next 20 years of career just needs to be like only... No photos, only just weird kind of like found things about you, you know?
Ron Sexsmith Repents. That's the name of your next album.
And he called me a degenerate. Like he actually looked me up in my Wikipedia and found out that I was married before and I'm not married, you know, and oh, that's like a sin too. So I'm like a... Anyway, and meanwhile, his kids aren't even talking to him, you know, because they... You know. So anyway, it's just this crazy world out there, but...
Well, you wear that like a badge of honor.
Well, I had to.
We're there.
Yeah.
I like it. It.
But
I think we were talking about Engelbert Humperdinck.
Engelbert Humperdinck, yeah, that's right.
There's been a lot of interesting information. Yeah. Said, you know, we went to Motorhead. What else? We had something in the middle that was...
Well, I hesitated to bring up the obvious things that everybody brings up
Right?
In every article and every interview.
Nuts, right?
And I must think that it does.
Yeah.
But now that you've dropped in this Engelbert thing, I had to keep going.
Yeah, yeah.
But one thing I will say is you've done a lot of stuff with YouTube and you do all these covers now. And some of them are like you hit it out of the park.
Thanks.
What are you going to do with the ones you score home runs with?
Oh, nothing. It's just for me. It was Twitter. I was like, what do I do with Twitter? Everyone's like, oh, I had a great salad today or, you know, whatever. So I just was trying to think of content, you know. And the other thing I did in my YouTube channel is I redid every one of my records, acoustic versions, right? So I've done that. And then I started with a thing called hotel covers, where when I was on the road on my last tour, every time I was in a room, I would do a cover song. And this year, since I'm not wasn't touring that much, I started just doing it around my house.
I noticed that.
And it's usually just songs that I love, you know? I'm like playing I did one by Gene McClellan the other day, you know, who wrote Snowbird, who's a great East Coast songwriter.
Mm-hmm.
I did an old Sonny James song. Like, these are just songs I grew up with as a kid I loved. Some of them I have to go on Google and get all the words, but mostly it's there in my head. I just figured out.
That's cool.
I did a Led Zeppelin one. I did a Chicago. Did
Do you get more hits for the Danzig? Zeppelin one?
Dancing Queen. I didn't do Dancing Queen. I did
Danzig.
I did Knowing Me, Knowing You.
Cool.
But I do back. You know all the
that's
all,
ABBA, right?
ABBA. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. So, but I every day it's like, who am I gonna do today? And
I did see that clip with you and Kim Mitchell trading off a Max Webster.
Yeah.
I've actually wanted to do an acoustic version of one of his solo songs.
Oh, which one? All We Are Is
No. No, not that one. It's now I'm gonna draw a blank. But I figured it out on guitar.
Not Easy to Tame.
Easy to Tame.
Yeah, that's a good one. Yeah.
Yeah, I figured that one out, mm-hmm. but I could never do it in front of him.
Well, it was nerve wracking for me. I really did my. I mean, I knew that song. In any way, because it was like tattooed in my. Because they were my favorite band when I was in high school. Mm-hmm. My favorite Canadian band,
Max Webster,
and I'd met him a few times, and he knew I was a fan. I think he was a bit afraid of me. You know, when you got an Uber fan.
Yes.
But then they asked me on the show, and the other one I do Words Tour. I do a lot of their songs, you know, and I love Let Go of the Line. I know that's not his song, but I love like Terry Watkins mm-hmm. and stuff too. But so that was a big moment for me to sing it with him. And then he was harmonizing too.
Yeah, it was an amazing moment because just knowing that obviously you're a super fan of his, you know this song.
Yeah.
What a lot of people don't know is, minus the last record, mm-hmm. I've been doing this for years quietly. Okay. And I guess I'll tell everyone on this podcast since Kim Mitchell's been brought up. But I go because he does his radio show for Q107 on the street.
Oh.
On Yonge Street.
Hard Rock Cafe, right?
Yeah, at the Hard Rock Cafe.
But they know they moved though.
Oh, that's probably why I didn't do it for the last album.
Yeah, they're now at the Chorus Building, but yeah, they used to be right there.
They used to be right on, so you could actually walk by and see Kim Mitchell of Max Webster. Yeah, which I always thought, like, isn't that annoying to you, Kim?
Yeah.
But it was great for me because I would, every time a record of ours was released, mm-hmm. I would quietly knock on the window and show him the album. Mm-hmm. He would come around during a commercial break. I would hand him the record, and I would leave.
Yeah, yeah.
And I could tell the last couple of times I did that, he wanted to talk a little more.
Yeah, yeah.
But I'm already just, like, too much of a fan. I just go, here's a new record, Kim. see you later. And I exit the street. So he's got the last few records up till Below the Belt, which is from 2010. Well,
he, you know, obviously they can't really play me on that station. So they played a snippet of whatever song I had out at the time. But it was great that we talked and... So, I don't know. He's a class act.
He is, man. I really like him. Yeah. I haven't met him. I've only handed him records.
Well, you should meet him.
Yeah, I know.
It's time. It's time, man.
Time.
Now, but if you're looking for him now, go to the Chorus Building and hand him your record.
Oh, I was ushering at your show at Massey Hall. That was fun.
You were an usher there, so.
I was an usher at Massey.
Did you know Kip Harness? He used to
Kip
be.
Kip Harness? No.
He's one of my favorite songwriters, but he was an usher for a brief period.
I actually remember I met you once and we were talking about that. Now that I'm getting a flashback. Yeah. But no, he worked there before I was there. Right? Yeah, and so I saw that Massey Hall show, which was
what, great. The first one? Yeah, because I did it. I'm going to play there in May, actually.
I must have been. How many times have you played there now?
This
twice?
Will be my fourth.
This okay, so it was probably the first or second one.
Right, okay.
You know? I remember being like, cool.
Well, I was just. That's my favorite. I just saw Lightfoot. Well, I go see Lightfoot every year, but I saw the Cat Stevens there.
How was Lightfoot?
Well, you know, I love Lightfoot. So, yeah. I mean, you know, he's a 76. So his voice is a bit frazzled, a bit, you know, but. It's still gored, you know.
And that was what I loved about the shows. Was like, because I would see every few years, you know, that he'd come out, and the band would be playing always slightly quieter, you know, like.
Well, he has to because he can't really project like he used to.
Yeah, you know? But I would kind of find that more like fragile in a good way, you know, like it would change a song like that Shadows song would like sound amazing. I love that.
Well, this show was funny because the first set was a bit. You know, shambolic, right? Like there were mistakes he kind of rallied. He came back the second set really strong, mm-hmm. you know, and he changed his jacket and he came out and by the end of the show everybody's on their feet and stuff. But yeah, I mean, I've been seeing him since the 80s and it's been interesting to see not just how his voice changed but his appearance and everything, you know, but everyone's getting older, right?
His demeanor. But apparently he's actually, you know, quite, you know, comparably jovial. Or in the last few years, you know.
Well, he was a bad drunk, I think, for a long time, and a mean drunk, I think. But he's a very, he's a very likable. He's mellowed out a lot.
I love his music so much; it's crazy.
I do. I like him too.
So anyway, I go to that every year. But I love that's my favorite venue. You
it know, is an incredible place.
It's incredible. Yeah. You get to play it.
Well, it took me long. When I was a courier. I work downtown, so I'd pass. I'd always have my eye on it, you know, like, oh, I'm going to get there someday, you know. Mm-hmm. I thought that was sort of attainable. Like, you know, the big, like, I played Royal Albert Hall a couple years ago.
Yeah.
And that's, I mean,
huge.
I've opened for people there, but I never in my wildest dreams thought I'd headline there. So that blew my mind. Playing Massey Hall, I always felt, yeah, I think I'm going to get
this. This feels right. This feels like it should have happened.
Yeah, so it finally happened, and that was cool. And now I'm really, and I haven't been there since 2008 or something, so it's been a while, so I'm looking forward to
So this is in conjunction with the new album being released. Yeah. That's great.
Wow.
Yeah. Ron, we got to have you back.
Okay.
Man. Yeah. This is just too...
Now I know where you live. It's easy, so...
It's too good to to not have you back on.
Yeah, well, I'll come back for sure. Do it again sometime.
Yeah, so I'm gonna keep that part on the podcast, so we're gonna hold you to it
as a verbal contract.
I'll come back. Yeah,
Ron, it was great to have you on.
Thanks.
We're gonna do it again.
The Danko Jones podcast is sponsored by Twitter.
Oh, it is.
No,
I mean, we're trying
to sponsored by social media.
And Engelbert Humperdinck.
And please tell Engelbert I'm a huge fan.
I will. Maybe he'll do the show. All right. Thanks, guys. Right.
Thanks, Ron.
Yeah, let's get them.
To us, men, all the children are dreaming of a world they can believe in. At Christmas, something to hold on to. The gift that makes life worth living. At Christmas, something to hold on to, something to hold on to. Every boy and every girl dreaming the same dream all over the world. They long to up to a better day and the better way. Let the bells